Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, how are you doing?
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
So, interesting week here. We talked a bit on Weird Things about the whole SpaceX thing, what they're doing there. I'd like to talk a little about future tech, and I've been playing around with, last week or so, with the both the iPhone, also with the AR kit, their AR stuff, and I've also been playing around with Google's AR Core, and Google has their own format for doing augmented reality. And, you know, I think everybody here knows what augmented reality is, but it's where, you know, projects images into your environment and stuff. And one of the kind of neat things is that iOS 12 has this. And again, I will talk about some Apple stuff, but there's going to be there'll be versions of that in Google or Android. So just you know, don't be like, oh, it's going to be all Apple, all this. It's just, you know, each company kind of like takes a lead doing something. Google did a lot of that voice speech recognition and stuff and all that. And then Apple followed suit, and AR is the thing that all of them are actively developing, et cetera. And augmented reality is kind of cool because the difference between augmented reality and virtual reality is that augmented reality, you can use on your phone right now. You can look at objects and do stuff. Things like Pokemon Go, you know, is an augmented reality game. And we're starting to see more of them. And like anything, we have to figure out like, what's it good for and how long is it good for? There are some really advanced AR games that are out there, but they're not great because you got to hold your phone up in front of your face for like, you know, an hour, and that's not fun. And so we're finding out the limits of that. Playing with some of the developer stuff for Apple, what's interesting is that I just showed before the show, the front camera, there's a developer app that Apple provides, which what it does is it uses, there's a point cloud. So the way that, you know, the iPhone camera has, it's basically Microsoft Kinect technology, or the company that made that technology, sends a point cloud onto your face. And that's how it does, which creates a 3D map of your face. And they actually have an app in there where you can use it to create a 3D model of your face just by holding the camera in front of you. Now, it only has data where it can see, but it can map my face onto those points. And in the not too distant future, we're going to be at a point where, you know, we're going to be creating live 3D content, interacting with it, and doing kind of neat stuff. But it's very interesting because like Apple unveiled a format at the developers conference with Pixar called USDZ. Have you guys seen this?
I remember them saying that they were working with Pixar on that, but I don't know what the actual implications of it are.
So what USDZ is it's a file format that basically is a AR file format that you can put an AR object inside of it. And what that allows you to do is that you don't need to put it into an app. You can actually put this file like you would an image into a, let's say, a web browser. So I have open up the gallery here and I'll show you. If you have an, if you have iOS 12, like you can select from different things here. And
so you've got some models pre-built into that little dialogue.
And so that's served by a web page. So I just clicked on this to load up this, it's just downloading this guitar into my phone, right? Again, it's all done through the browser, right? And so it's an open format. Anybody, you know, any other buddy wants to implement it. So you can see like, hey, there's a guitar. It's in 3D. I can pan around it. But I'm going to go point this at my dirty desk.
Sure. And yeah. That model that he was kind of messing around with, he was able to move and rotate it around, not in an app, but within the mobile web browser.
So. Yeah, and I'll show you what makes this cool is now I'm going to bring the camera around here. Ooh. And you look at my phone.
Okay, so right? He's pretty quickly put the guitar onto his desk.
Yeah.
And is able to sort of show it in AR with it being imposed directly on
right.
his keyboard.
And that rendering is really good.
And
like, they do a lot of everybody's like AR, we get it. But like they do a lot of really cool stuff, and they're like it actually reflects the environment around it. So if there's any reflective surfaces and stuff, so if the guitar has metal on it, you'll actually see the keyboard in front of it. They do a lot of really cool stuff to make it feel blended in the environment. And when I do it full scale, you'll get like it looks real. Mm-hmm. What's neat about this is that's all served up from the browser. So it's just one file format. It takes like, you know, three lines of HTML and you all of a sudden have an AR object or whatever embedded. So
yeah, and I mean,
kind of a cool very thing, you know, where we're headed mm-hmm. is that we're now getting, you know, we have a, you know, an augmented reality file format.
Yeah, like I'm looking at some app that uses the depth data from these photos to change lighting in a still photo just based off of the depth data the camera provides. So they're adding colors, they're moving it within depth space.
Yeah. We're seeing a photo of somebody holding a dog in their lap, and as they move the light around the photo, it only hits one side or the other of the dog. And yeah. So it's not, it's like very realistic.
Yeah, I think they've got another one here with some wooden structures, and they're like little wooden trays. But it's, you know, you can do something like this when you have very accurate depth data, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, this is really cool. This is called immersive Apollo immersive illumination. That's crazy, man.
Yeah, it's wow. We're heading fast into, you know, when the phone inside everybody's pocket is able to real time process. And that's the thing, is like, you know, showing this to friends who've been in, you know, VFX for years, where they're watching AR kit in real time, you know, 60 frames per second, process this image and create a hyper realistic object in space that the camera can pan around and move with. I mean, it's insane, you know. Yeah. You know, the computations this does, they have what's called plane detection. So the iPhone tries to figure out what's a flat plane, and now they're able to do flat surfaces and also walls. So you're going to start seeing apps and stuff where, you know, interactive VR experiences where it will, you can now map your house. You can walk around with your phone and create a whole 3D map of your house. So then, you know, there's a company that just got funding, and what they're going to do is they're developing like immersive games that will adapt to your environment around you, you know, which, you know, sort of the obvious sort of select, you know, thing to do with that. And the idea is that you might download an AR game and walk around your house, then all of a sudden it constructs a level based upon the room you're in.
Wow. This is incredible like technology. And I think what's really exciting is that on the hardware side, we are pretty much on the precipice, if not already past the line of being able to satisfy the hardware requirements, right? The baseline, like,
oh,
they're,
yeah.
They're putting the cameras in phones now. The phones are strong enough now to process this data. And so now it's up to like developers and creators to figure out various ways to use this information.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I think the biggest limitations so far are battery, right? Mm-hmm. So anything that is going for a long time, it is going to kill the battery. It's the reason why for Pokemon Go, despite the fact that it does have really good AR stuff in it, most people who play it a lot turn it off, just because it's already a battery intensive game that takes even more. And application, like just finding the way that, okay, well, how do people want to use it? Like, what makes this infinitely better? Like, you know, be it entertainment or storytelling or utilitarian, like what is the thing that like it makes it worth it just for like one time? So map out your apartment, just so now no matter what, when you're in
a furniture store
anywhere, yeah, a furniture store, you're gonna buy at the Home Depot or you're gonna buy a frame, mm-hmm. you can now have an immediate like, okay, knowing the dimensions of this, I can put it literally anywhere and something like that. Like there's gotta be, I'm bullish on AR because even though it hasn't exploded, I think that all the tinder is there. It is dry. There is gasoline sitting next to it. And there is a stack of matches that is like literally just waiting for this to be something that can take off.
You know what I think is something that can help kickstart this, or I think so on the new version of iOS, I don't know if you need to have one of the iPhone 10s with the dual cameras or not, but they now have the Measure app, which mm-hmm. is AR based, and so you move your phone around so it gets an idea of where you are, and you can set points on an object, and it'll do clicking because it can recognize a little bit of where you know, where the ends of objects are, and it will give you, like, as far as I could tell, playing around with it a little bit this weekend, really accurate, you know, measuring information. And that's something that I would use every once in a while. I don't know. If you don't have a tape measure, if you're out and about and you need to know how long something is, like that's, it's a small thing for a small use case, but using it in that way was so like intuitive to use out of the gate, and you know, seemed to be relatively error free, that I think it could get people more used to, like, oh, there are AR solutions for problems.
And that's you know, we're delineating between the difference between AR and VR, and Apple's very bullish on AR. Apple is very, very bullish on AR as opposed to VR, and Apple's got their own internal reason. And I understand a lot of it, because it's there's one thing, hey, I'm going to put myself in this headset in this entire environment, and that's going to, you know, that'll be, I own a couple different headsets and stuff, and it's not fun for extended periods of time. The gear is just not there right now, but that's like judging, you know, like, you know, I played Pong. I don't think there's a future to this video game because it gets boring. It's like, just the hardware, eventually what happens is the hardware gets incrementally better and more people are get into it, until all of a sudden it's like phones. Like, I don't need a phone. I don't need a phone. Like, I can make phone calls from home. And then all of a sudden one day, who doesn't have one, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to be like, we're going to be in VR every day, or, you know, AR. The rumor is Apple's working on their own set of glasses, like Magic Leap, like other people, their own AR glasses. I can tell you from looking at the developer stuff, the code and everything, I mean, their tools are really much further advanced than anybody else in there. And they did a very interesting thing, and I've heard nobody mention this, so I'll be the first place to mention this. They have, like, the default formats and stuff. They talk about, like, you know, what size, you know, you need to have, like, like an app or things like this. 16 by 9 or whatever tends to be sort of a standardized sort of video size. Apple just said, hey, all of your augmented reality stuff, the default size is going to be 4:3. Right? You know, much more square aspect ratio.
Okay. In line with the iPads, sure.
Yeah, but it's not like the iPad. But here's the thing, is like when you watch the Apple developer stuff, they talk about like holding these things up in front of your extended periods of time is a pain in the ass, right? And so holding up an iPad in front of you a really long period of time is a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And it, because of the iPad, in my opinion, it's because when Apple comes up with Apple glasses or whatever they're gonna be, if you're going to put one image per eye, you're going to use probably a 4:3 size chip. And I think it's in, just like they built in compatibility for the iPad into the iPhone technology, the iPhone software stuff way before the iPad came out.
Right.
That's what I think they're doing now, is they know, like, okay, you're going to have one frame per eye, even if it's on one, you know, sensor, what one sensor per eye, it's going to be a 4:3. And so what'll happen is, you know, 4:3, and then you need, you know, the default format is to make it automatically work already. So,
yeah.
You know, to me, that I looked at that, I'm like, that's the only reason that made sense to me. So
that is interesting, because, you know, we know that they are going to be working on new iPads probably for later this year, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get Face ID or depth cameras
probably
on both sides.
I think
you're right that there's more than one reasoning for it.
I do think that that's, you know, that's going to be a gigantic space to tackle, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, and I know we've had a history, I think deservedly so, of ragging on the initial Google Glass kind of demo thing, but like there's a reason why that idea really took off for people, that initial concept, not what happened, but the initial idea of, hey, like directions and, you know, alert managed alerts. Right. And also it's something where now, specifically in where Apple is in its philosophy of trying to be the place that is pushing, hey, here's your screen time reminder. Like, here's your way that you can manage, you know, your usage. We understand that you're always going to want to have a smartphone, but now we want to also be in the wellness, the 360 wellness space of how to do stuff. I think Apple's in a unique position where it's not just going to be, they want to sell you a lifestyle of, you're keeping these on your head for a larger period. We want it to be a part of your life, a seamlessly integrated kind of portion of your life that then can also do other stuff, which is, I think, why they've had such a gigantic push into AR now. But also, I think you're right. Going forward, the AR glasses are going to be something that I think Apple has a unique. They have carved really in Tim Cook's world. In Tim Cook's Apple, there are two things that I think are his babies: the watch and whatever we see out of AR. Mm-hmm. Like those are his. He's always been a hardware guy. Those are going to be his hardware legacies. And
I'll tell you why I'm excited about it is the idea that, like, you know, the AirPods nailed it.
Oh,
I know. And I put it in my ear and it switched over to the AirPod. That was what happened. Is it immediately said, oh, AirPod? It was like, it's that the Bluetooth now is like, oh, you want to use the AirPod to talk now? We can do that. And so that's what it started to do.
Oh, right. Cause, yeah.
But as a design, as a form factor, you know, they did really, 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 really good with that. You know, I mean, like it's really like I bought their first Bluetooth, you know, which was, you know, an interesting first attempt that I think I put in the washer like twice. But you had a battery problems and the same problems other Bluetooth had. But it was at the time was like one of the smallest Bluetooth anybody made. But then they realized, nah, we're not really nailing it. So they stopped making them. And then when they finally came out, the AirPods, they're great. They're really, really great. Like you look kind of dumb with them, but it's just, they're so, you see some nails. I'm like, they're so functional. You're like, yeah, but I get it. It's worth it.
Yeah. I got the Beats X. I know Justin, you have the Beats X also.
Yeah.
The AirPods have been tempting to see.
I'm in on them. You know, I like my Beats X, but they're getting chewed to crap by my bird. So my bird can't chew an AirPod. And my biggest worry with the AirPods initially was that they at launch kind of looked a little dorky. But now culture has shifted that now, you know, everybody, you know, has an onion hanging from their belt, as was fashion at the time. And so that's really all I care about. I'll definitely be upgrading to the AirPods.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's, you know, Apple's done some things really well. Some things frustrate me to no end. And, you know, I'm not all in on everything on that. But I know that the capability they have there to do that. And I think AR has potential. And the problem is it's like, you know, we're looking at this stuff trying to figure out what are things going to be like 5 years from now. We don't know. When, you know, the iPhone first shipped, you know, there was no app store yet. You know, there were security concerns and stuff. And now we live in an internet that's shaped by App Store and Google Play. You know, those are important drivers of our economy. You know, that 10 years ago, they did not exist. There were notional ideas, but 10 years ago, the idea that, you know, these things were going to be, you know, the primary way that we kind of found the tools and software to interact with somebody, nobody was clear that was going to happen. And then, you know, imagine 10 years ago trying to explain Instagram.
Right.
You know, like, oh, it's, you know, it's, you know, people share photos like, oh, like Flickr. I mean, no, you comment on them. Like, yeah, like Flickr, but no, on your phone. Like, yeah, okay. It's like, it's big. It's one of the biggest social networks there is. Yeah. I don't see Flickr growing into that. I don't see that. You know, not that many people take photos. I think you're exaggerating. It's like, no, because everybody will have a camera on their phone, but no, people aren't really good photographers. Yeah, but they'll add filters at first that'll make it easy to make your photos look better, and then the cameras on phones are going to get great. No, they can't, because you see, you need a bigger lens, you need a bigger barrel and all that. You can't. Have you seen an iPhone? Have you seen a camera? And you'd just be like, no, they're going to spend billions of dollars on making cameras on phones, the most sophisticated pieces of technology we have. More tech will go into cameras than probably 747 jets. No, I don't see it. I'm sorry.
Well, and that's what's, yeah. And part of that is like Instagram is like in the broad strokes very similar to Flickr, but the entire paradigm of using Instagram is completely different, right? Mm-hmm. Having a timeline, having likes and comments be proportioned out the way that they are.
The difference between Flickr and Instagram to me is the generational shift of how we think about the internet. Flickr was about, hey, here's a great site where no matter how high the resolution of your photos are, you can store all your photos forever. And we're going to be about organization, and you can make cool things, because this is what we want you to do, is upload every photo you take forever to Flickr. And here are our cool pro packages where you can make sure that you can always do that for a price. And Instagram's about, show the photo that you just took now. And we're going to give you little ways that you can make it very quickly look better. But this is about take a photo, show a photo, and maybe even delete a photo. Because we're not even going to make it really easy for you to scroll from photo to photo. Yeah. This is about looking at a thing. This is presentational. That's
and,
it.
And breaking out the workflow of like, okay, you took all these photos. Now you got to put them on your computer and open up Lightroom and edit them in Lightroom and make your picks. And then you put them on an album in Flickr. And then you got to share that album because no one uses Flickr. Where it's like, you're here, you just took the photo at the place, you did a filter in 2 seconds, you adjusted the tilt shift, and you put your comment and some hashtags, and you tagged people, and now it's out. And now it's in, you know, you shrunk down the process of it, too.
Well, not just. But also, like, a big factor is everybody you knew could have it. Mm-hmm. Everybody I knew had a camera when Instagram came out, everybody had a camera on their phone. Everybody had the camera, had access to the camera. Now, and just to give an example of how we see things, I mean, in no one point of view is necessarily superior to another. Laura Mann says making it sarcastically, no, managing applications from a central repository was never a thing before app stores. That's not how I see the app store. It's like saying, nope, selling books wasn't a thing before Amazon. Yeah, you're right. But second largest company in the world, because the way it was done, how it was done, and then the services they came out of that, AWS, which was really their big driver. And that's just it. Is it like, yeah, these things exist in some form before, but all of a sudden somebody changes it and makes it Flickr to Instagram. Flickr was, hey, now it's on your phone. Mm-hmm. By the way, phones have cameras. And now everybody you know has a camera and can take photos anytime they want and not have to go through the process of transferring cards and all this. It's like, yeah, taking photos and sharing with people, that was a thing before Instagram. Somehow, what did Instagram do? It wasn't a big technological leap. It just had to be, you know, the prevalence of cameras and phones and things like this and actually simplifying it a thing.
Which is why, you know, you keep seeing like new attempts at social networks right now and them trying to be a little different, but kind of different versions of what we have now. Whereas, you know, whatever apps we're using 10 or 15 years from now will probably be relatively different from what we're using now, in the same way that what we're using now is relatively different from a MySpace or AIM or ICQ, whatever.
That's what Delora Mint says. Distro repositories were actually curated to an extent. Yeah, and like, how many times has your mom typed git init into a command line? It's yes, these things are there, but there's a point at which it becomes appified and streamlined, and the average person who has no idea what's going on behind the scenes, and there's a platform where you say, as I talk about those friends, like, oh, I have an idea for this. And like, do we make it web-based or app-based? Like, no, you should probably make it app-based because people trust app. You know, they know the average person knows what an app store is. They know to go get it. They know how to do this versus, you know, oh, you know, just brew dot, you know, it's not that. It's this, you know,
there's so much of as pattern recognizing creatures, we can either look at what is similar or we can recognize what is different. Mm. And that's the biggest thing that I think is philosophical. Like that's something that I find myself every day whenever I look at something and I'm like, ah, I mean, come on. Well, that could be better. That could be different. That could be changed. You know, well, I don't know why you did this when you could have done this. And it's like, well, how about I shut up and instead of thinking how this is similar to things that I have an understanding about, how about I understand and appreciate what is different? Why this is here? Why this changed? Why people glommed onto it? Because I think that there's, you know, to not put too fine a point on it, that might be the source of all knowledge. Like that might be literally the only things worth paying attention to.
I agree. And I think I fall victim to that a lot because it's like we try to imagine the future by imagining just sort of a bigger version of the present. And, you know, I started going to VRLA, or these meetups that grew into this big, huge sort of events. And I think I took you to one, Justin, a couple years ago. And so I went to one of the first ones was like 60 people. Now like thousands of people show up at these things and watching people talk about VR and what it's going to be and what it's going to be. And I was interested in playing the tech, but I was not like, this is the year. And I get into kind of somewhat arguments of people like, oh yeah, next year it's going to blow up. I'm like, why do you say that? oh, because every phone now can be plugged into this thing and can do VR. I'm like, yeah, I've done that. It's not a great experience. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not there yet. You know, I'm like, it's not there yet. And it's not to say, and people are like, oh, well, you know, they said that about this. I'm like, I'm not saying it won't be there. I'm just saying it's not Tuesday, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it takes a lot of these different technologies to come out and try to have their thing and be clunky and be whatever it is, too early, too expensive, too processor intensive, until we reach that point where everything converges to passing that bar once and then 10 times, and then everything passes that bar just by, definition.
I would say an analogy would be if you looked at portable computer was like the Osborne. I want to say it was the Osborne portable, right? There may have been some other brand before that. But if you look at the first portable computer, the Osborne, mm-hmm. French Bryce might find a photo of that. And you tell somebody that like, oh yeah, one day like everybody's going to have something like this. You're like, no, this thing is giant and clunky and it sucks, you know, and trying to imagine the idea that, hey, you know, well, guess what? Like, you know, 10, 12 years from the Osborne computer, we're actually going to make LCD screens better. We're not going to have to use CRTs and stuff. You look at this thing and this computer is bigger than the PC sitting on most people's desktops.
Yeah.
And that was a portable computer back in the day.
Is this a CRT monitor in the middle here?
Yeah, it's CRT.
Oh my goodness. It's like, it says 5 inches in between two like mini floppy disk drives.
And remember, these were computers that you had to load the operating system onto when you booted up too, right? So yeah. To look at an Osborne circa like, was that 1984, 93, or forget what that year that was.
Oh, those aren't mini floppies. Those are full-size floppies. Sorry.
Yeah, those are the giant ones. Right. Those are some War Games floppies. So to look at that and say, yeah, this is the future, it's like, but the screen's going to be so small. It's all this. It's hard to imagine where we are today. And, a Chromebook that like, you know, you can buy a $200 laptop that runs circles around that thing. But, and that's, I think, with AR and VR is it's like, you know, the hardware we're looking at now. Yeah, there's still going to be, you look through a thing and maybe you put it on your face, but you look at, and an example I've used is like, look at how much we've been spending billions of dollars on phone cameras. Like phone camera technology is amazing when you look at how small these things are and the capabilities when you're getting 15 megapixel sensors and something this size, you know, that can fit into a sugar cube. And it's taking, you know, you can take a photo with that. That takes up more memory space than if you took the largest computer system we had in the 1980s, like the Sabre computer system. One photo now is like probably great, has more data than every hard drive, you know, every disk space thing that was available, you know, and at time. And that's going to keep evolving and, you know, changing. So, going back to the VR LA thing, people are like, oh, look, we just shot this little feature in VR. Like, we think it's going to happen. People are going to watch VR movies. And I'm like, I like VR. I don't really want to watch a VR movie. Like, I'm not saying that I won't, but, you know, like, hey, and I can look around when I'm in the bunker with the soldiers. And it's like,
it would need to be really deliberate for me to spend an hour and a half watching a VR film. And you wouldn't get me to buy a VR system to watch it. I would need, like, to go somewhere. Like, you know, I don't even watch a lot of movies at home. So I would need some sort of movie theater equivalent of VR to put me in there for the best VR movie that's been ever made yet.
I don't think even something as rad as, you know, Elon Musk sending a thing around the moon that I can watch in high definition VR. That'll be something that'll do for like 20 minutes, maybe, you know, 30 minutes. Like I'll try to watch as much of the moon stuff as possible. But like in general, if I leave it on, it'll probably be on my regular old monitor and I'll just be able to, you know, scroll. But like, look, VR right now is, it's a lot closer to that Osborne portable computer than it is to the iPhone. And so what we're seeing now with how fast we saw. I mean, like, to look at where smartphone development was, the reason why that rush was as fast as it was, and let's look at it from, what, 07 is when the iPhone comes out, to just that first 10 years, to 2017. That was like a 10-year breakneck pace of evolution. We were on like the bleeding edge of data and hardware and software. Like, that was a magic moment. That was a magic decade that now we are still benefiting from, but it's become a little bit more commoditized and a little bit more incremental. So to look at some of this other stuff, I think we look at it like, okay, well, if it's not having that smartphone decade, then, well, the market's decided. There's no room for VR. AR's just a fun magic trick. And it's like, I don't think so. I think that smartphones were at a very unique place at the point that the iPod and the iPod Touch was also there. There was like a confluence of a couple different things that sort of made that decade as magical as it could be, where we're just now getting to that point where it's like, you know, to Eoxy asked, like, is there a piece of tech that is separating us from AR being an everyday thing?
Yes.
It's glasses, but we're not there technically, but I think we're close, and we've got whatever the equivalent of the magic moment for the iPod Touch was, that you just said, like, oh my God, they throw a phone on this thing, it's gonna be legit. and the forward thinking mobile web kind of idea was just exactly where we needed to be. I think we're kind of there with AR. We just don't have the one thing. And I think we're close.
I would say that, like, the modern phone took off because of the confluence of several things happening. Screens got, you know, were LCD screens were good enough. Touch interactions, that was before the iPhone came out. There was like, how are we going to interact with this thing? Is it going to be a little mouse wheel? Was it this, whatever? Because touch screens at that point were not that good.
They were still mostly resistive. You had to use the stylus. They were for PDAs. That's
awesome. My favorite part of the initial iPhone announcement is Steve Jobs on a menu flicking it up, and it's like the most routine, boring thing now, but listen to the pop that gets from that audience with the idea of, like, I touched and flick and it has its own physics.
Yeah. And that was for, you know, the Steve Jobs understood you have to feel like this was a physical thing, which is why they had all the skeuomorphic designs. You have to feel like it's a physical thing. He's like, if we're going to touch the screen, things need to move like they do with your fingers. And that became the pain. And you could say, well, that was the obvious choice. That would be the obvious thing. It wasn't obvious at the time that that's where all the effort should be put into, you know, that was where you should put that energy into. It wasn't clear to anybody, you know, that people could say, yeah, not in the future, we'll be able to do this. And then Apple made a bet, like, let's spend the money and the time to figure out how to do this now.
Yeah,
they did that. And then you had LCD screens themselves, the quality got better. But it's funny, you look at your old first Android or first iPhone screen, and you're like, oh my God, this is horrible. I can see all the lines and stuff, the screen door. And you look at now, and you know how these displays are just seamless. There was the battery tech, cellular data, you know, confluence of a few things that came together,
which was kind of the overall, in step with 3G.
Edge to 3G to LTE, and that all happens within that decade, right? Like, that we have three, like, national rollouts of data capacity that increasingly gets better and faster.
You know, and then the idea of creating the stork idea, like, this is where you go to, you know, before internet, you go anywhere, you get your apps, and they're like, there were places that, you know, different companies had their own, like, Windows headed stuff, and you buy apps or whatever from here. But the App Store and the Google Play stay of, like, no, like, here's the thing. Here's the little box where you go to search for the thing. This is, somebody tells you the name of it. This is the box where you enter it in and you'll find it. And just that concept alone for the average person was helpful. But those paradigms change everything. For AR, AR doesn't necessarily, the final point for AR may not be the glasses, you know. I don't think, and we know that in the far off thing is going to be like the neural lace or whatever, the thing that goes in your head and you just plug it and see there. Mm-hmm. I think the next big step will be glasses, but we're doing really interesting stuff now with like lasers and laser illumination and stuff. And imagine thinking about the not too distant future when you have a house, we already have smart bulbs. Like you guys probably have dozens of smart bulbs around you. Imagine when every bulb around you is basically a projection TV system, mm-hmm. right? And everything that's illuminated in your house is illuminated by something like that. So when you want to have an AR experience, your house becomes this thing. Justin just looks like Obi-Wan Kenobi now. And I think that's kind of a not too far out version is going to be, you can have the glasses, but also like, oh yeah, my house is rigged up for AR because every light in here can either, you know, because you can create really incredible 3D looking systems if you can track people and create things that move with you and track with you. And when you control the surface, that'll be kind of a cool thing.
Plus, I mean, look, ICE says every demo is putting a dinosaur on a table or some useless thing. Just all I'm asking is just let's assume that is Hello World.
Right.
That's every website's every website's just a page that says Hello World. Who cares, right? Just that this is a tool. It is a functionality. I do think. Look, there's a point. The larger question is what gets us to the point where we don't care about this anymore.
Yeah,
that's your question, because it will happen and it will happen sooner than we think.
I see. Man, your point. Like, I was at one of these VR things, and somebody says, like, oh yeah, we've got a new VR company like that. You should try our demo. And I said, okay, before I put this on, am I going to see a skate park or a concert? And there is this pause, like, oh, you've seen it. I'm like, no, I've seen every other demo. Right. And it's the only thing people can think to show is a skate park or a concert. And it's like, well, we're going to do concert streaming. Like, yeah, that's going to be the breakthrough. And you just sort of reach this point where it's like the developers, people who are working on the tech, there's, you get one, people working on the code. They don't have any, often don't have any ideas on what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And then you get the people, the opportunists who come in here are like, I can do this. And they're just looking at like, how can I make money? You know? And it takes a while to figure out. Remember the first App Store apps? You know, what was the number one? It was like the fart app, you know?
It takes time for the software and hardware integration to work just right. I saw a video over the weekend with some of the early, with some of the guys who were at Apple while they were developing the iPhone. And, you know, they talk about, you know, at the time they wanted to use a click wheel style interface for the iPhone. Because they had the iPod, and that was, you know, talking about taking the popular thing and blowing that up until they realized, oh, well, when you want to put a phone number in, it's just a rotary phone. We've gone back to the rotary dial.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time for someone to get over that hump. Or when they were talking about keyboards, right? You know, they had like 80 different keyboard prototypes, and it wasn't until someone was like, well, what if we adjust the touch type, the touch targets as you're typing, so you're more likely to type the right code, the right letters, mm-hmm. and suddenly typing on a touch screen becomes fast and
remember
accurate.
The iPhone is doomed because it didn't have a physical keyboard. Right. That was conventional wisdom. It's doomed. Physical people need a physical keyboard. It's doomed.
The BlackBerry at the time.
Wanted it to be an iPhone version of BlackBerry. Now, try to find a phone that has a physical keyboard.
Right.
Yeah. And OpenBio brings up, convincing people to use it. He brings up 3D TV. I don't think it's convincing people to use it. I think it's creating something that's useful. 3D TV was useless. It was, hey, everybody, I got this 3D TV. It's great. Well, it came with four pairs of glasses. If anybody else wants to come watch it with me here, I need to buy some extra glasses to it. And now we're going to watch this thing. You know, we're going to watch a football game in 3D, which – granted, in my argument about 3D is that 3D effectively, really as far as the brain process, kind of stops once you get to the edge of your fingertips, because that's where it's useful. Beyond that, we have other ways of telling distance, and demos that are really good are ones that cheat it or whatever. And you know, watching sports games and stuff like that, I'm like, there's cool stuff with AR where like you watch a basketball game on your coffee table, and I'm like, that might be kind of cool. There's the factor of how long you want to wear the glasses for. But 3D TV was, I think, pushed pushed by companies because TV companies made a ton of money when he went to HD because we're buying HD, we're buying new players, buying all this sort of stuff. And they saw this gold rush with 3D TV. They're like, well, we'll get everybody buying 3D TVs, right? And then they're going to all have this.
And also, ESPN and sports and stuff were a focus because that was a big change when it came to HD. Mm-hmm. Everyone, it's to go from pre-HD from standard def to high def on sports, you were like, oh my God, this is a wholly different different thing. But 3D is just too immersive, and it forgets the fact that HD for sports is passive, whether or not people realize it, and they confuse fandom and passion for not realizing that. Even people who are hardcore, like Bryce is a Oregon Ducks fan.
Go Ducks.
Like you're gonna go to the bathroom every once in a while.
Right.
Like you're gonna turn around. You're gonna look down at your at your snacks. You're gonna turn over to talk about how I can't believe the refs didn't make that call. It's something that you're taking the eye off the television a lot. Mm-hmm. High def made it more compelling. Now you were more pulled to the screen because it was an amazing image and it was easy. The corner of your eye would show you this amazing thing and you'd look. 3D is the opposite. It's like if you're not
focused, yeah.
You're not like dead on, which I don't know who other than like people who are paid to do it are going to watch literally every frame of a football game or a hockey game or a basketball game.
Yeah.
Now it's a pain in the ass whenever you want to look over to your friend and say, can you believe that they did that? And so 3D was always doomed. It was always something that was going to be fraudulent because it was a gimmick and it didn't have a developmental path forward. There was no way, unless you were going to develop a way to do glasses-less 3D, it was doomed. It was DOA.
Yeah. And you look at like VR and some of the way like VR, like talking about concerts and skate parks being the like 3D video, you know, demo of choice. There's a similar thing with VR or AR in terms of presenting like things like esports. Like Dota has I don't know if it's an AR or a VR mode, but you put in a thing and you get to like fly over the map and see all the mobs and stuff. But you know, it's I think esports is in a very similar paradigm to what Justin described with television sports, is that that's probably more passive than a virtual reality headset is designed for.
And I think part of it is that like when we watch something, our real area interest point of view is like this, you know, it's in front of us like this. And you look at where people feel most comfortable when they want to sit from a TV, like when you put a TV, how big of a TV you want, how close you sit to it. And that tells you, you know, if everybody liked to watch TV from 1 foot away, then I'd be like, yeah, VR is going to be really, you know, that use for VR is going to be extremely huge. But no, for a lot of the content we use now, video games even, we have this comfort zone of like, I'm here because once I dim the lights and I watch this, this is immersive to me. This is very, very much around me. I think that when we're able to make VR experiences way more sophisticated than they are now and the hardware less intrusive. Like I've done The Void and other stuff and those things are cool, but you're very conscious of the fact you've got a bunch of heavy gear on you and it's not something you want to do. But when it's not and you really feel like you're there, that'll be different. You don't feel like, you know, Six Degree of Freedom adds a lot to like making things believable, but you're still, it's like I'm 6 degrees of freedom, but I feel like when I scuba dive, when I've got like my rebreather pack and all this other stuff on me and I'm very weighted down. Yeah. And I think that's the difference is once we get past that, then it might be different. But now, you know, people like, oh, we're going to do narrative in 3D. Like, well, or in VR, like, it's like, well, here's the thing about narrative is like narrative is a director making choices. If I put somebody in the middle of us and tell you, you have to decide where to look to capture the story, that's a game. And that's fine, but it better be a really good game.
Or you have to have directors who are able to control actions such that you're guided to look in the right direction, you know?
Yeah, but now you're making me turn my head and work for it, you know, where here it's kind of like, I'm like, I just want to watch this thing, and now I got to work to do this, which, you know, when I watch TV, I just want to put my head on a pillow and just watch.
Yeah, and I don't know how VR will get over the hump of, like, the standing-sitting dichotomy. of like some stuff is made for sitting, looking in generally 180 degree range. Some stuff is for standing, and some stuff's for flailing and ducking and moving. There's a lot of freedom in the ability to create very different experiences, but that also means that it's not structured and standardized the way the TV or video is necessarily.
I think Bryce, we're going to get to a point where once the technology is pervasive from whatever, it's like, oh, you guys want to go play a tabletop game? We're going to play a tabletop game. You know, and we know we're going to sit in front of a table and maybe in different locations. We're going to play a tabletop game. We're going to do this. Oh, you guys want to go do, you know, some immersive thing, like, oh, cool, we can do it. We can, you know, network, and then we can in our houses, we can do this cool exploration thing. I think for the full VR experience, I think we need to go a lot further as far as the hardware and being able to create something that's, you know, lets you stand in place or walk or whatever and experience it. Yeah. But that's why AR, I think that's why Apple's excited about AR. It's like AR is like, oh, it takes your physical space and it puts this thing on top of it, so you know what it is, you know. But even the games they have for that are kind of like, great, I'm looking at a table watching things move around, yeah. You know. And it's like,
and that's the thing. By the way, I think the immediate AR applications are probably in like filters and stuff for videos and integrating them in easier, well, funnier, sillier ways.
Well, that's
you
what
can
Snapchat does. You know, Snapchat, like the stuff, the face filters and stuff, it's AR. You know, the thing, I'm going to put, you know, the cat nose on you. So, I mean, that and the glasses. And that's, you know, we're seeing that. And I agree. I think that AR becomes virtual objects. And I think that's virtual objects and experiences. And I think that becomes a different paradigm. I think there's a lot of potential there.
I mean, I know that we're not exactly the Snapchat demo, so it might be a little weird, but it's like, if you're looking for the killer application, like, they have it. It's called, you have a dog face, and when you lift your eyebrows, your tongue hangs out. Like, that's the killer app that has utilized AR technology, and it has for the past 2 years. So imagine that. What's the quantum leap past that? What's the social or the play past that utilizes that and takes it to the next level? And then past that, like, okay, well, now we've already had this stuff. We have a generation that's used to being able to do this, to look into their phone and have a crazy, silly party hat on their face that starts singing and dancing. Mm-hmm. What now? Where do we go?
Yeah.
I'm going to show you.
Oh.
Sending you something, Justin.
All right, so text messages are being sent around. We'll cut all this out. This is great.
Yeah,
no worries. Just leave this in. This is the suspense.
this is the suspense.
Yeah, open by you. As far as 3D goes, look, it was, is, and will forever be remembered as a cynical cash grab by television producers.
Boom. Which wouldn't be the first one. No. Nobody knows the shape of things. People try a bunch of different things, and sometimes
hold on,
somebody.
Wait a minute. I gotta hold on. I got an urgent text message.
Oh, let's see. He's looking at his phone.
It's literally me. I don't know. I don't know what I'm supposed to think of that Andrew has at the ready an emoji of me. It was me talking to me on this.
I'll tell you what, man, those animoji are really cool. They create
I haven't
one.
Made an animoji of me, and I just I just got me talking to me via animoji.
That's
oh
it.
Oh my god.
Well, that's the scary kind of thing too, is it like you saw that 3D depth thing, like the camera, right? And you know, I showed you like how that does that. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have the problem of deep fakes, and now, you know, Adobe has the whole vocoder thing, you know, to can replicate like people's voices.
Voco, yeah.
And that's not gonna be, Adobe ain't gonna be the only one that's gonna have that tech. You know, we're, you know, and the thing about deepfakes is interesting is that people have shown examples of how they're able to do that better than the Hollywood studios were able to do, like, you know, face mapping and stuff, you know, because somebody else.
Yeah, no, the whole Superman's mustache thing.
Oh, did somebody do it better already or?
Yeah. Oh, no. Like, but when the movie came out, they used a lot of that facial mapping stuff and were able to do it better, faster, cheaper.
Though in a lot of cases, you know, with the deepfake stuff, that is at really low resolution, right? That's my understanding right now, is that deepfakes tends to rely on being very slow, very low resolution, which outside of just like the general fuzziness of something small being able to look a different way in your mind's eye, but that also vastly reduces the amount of processor time and the sample size necessary.
Maybe, but I will tell you that there are advances in AI and the systems they use for doing that happening every five or six months. There is a new thing. We've gone from GANs. There's now augmented random search ARS, which is like another, like, it's part of it too. It's like, I have friends in VFX stuff and you talk about the tools they're using, and some of the stuff that they use are like, we just used a point mapping. They're not using any type of AI stuff to do this. And you're like, there's like, I think at deepfakes, probably some of that stuff was helped by that, but really like AI is really, really good now at facial mapping and understanding and being able to do that. Like the whole, so I think part of it too, for some of the people who were kind of got a little bit of some of the VFX, traditional VFX people, you know, it's amazing because you say like, oh, is anybody working on this? Like, no, because it's like, it's, you know, Adobe's pretty ahead of the curve on that. But from the time that somebody says, hey, here's a cool tech we can use, to when it makes it out there. But I mean, it's like, you know, I saw the stuff where they did Princess Leia's face and it's way better than the one they did in, you know, Rogue One. And like, and it, the res looked fine to me. The res in Rogue One didn't look so good. And this looked better.
Okay. I think, yeah, and ultimately the problem with technology is it oftentimes goes faster than it would take a busy professional to decide that they need to learn new tools, right? And every artist on some level will be beholden to their tools, until they decide that they need to upgrade, right? And in this field, oh my God, is it moving at a breakneck pace.
Yeah, I have a friend who's one of these kind of people they hire when they need to fix somebody else's mistakes and stuff like that. And he knows the tools and stuff, but it's like, I know he's going to use, you know, the keyframe tools and these things like this. And he's got a better eye for that. And he's going to break it down into, you know, go from 60 to 120 frames. He's going to do some other things to sort of, the other people wouldn't do in a traditional pipeline to do it, but I get it. But it's like, you start talking about some of this, you know, the AI generative sort of stuff, and his eyes glaze over, because it's like, if it's not in his toolbox, if it's not in DaVinci or not in whatever he's using, it's like, it's not, you know, in his world. Yeah. And I've dealt with that talking to law enforcement people about stuff, about like, you know, like, oh, you know, we talked to our experts and we're not able to get the data from this. And it's like, have you asked about wavelet analysis? And like, don't even know what that is. It's like, all right, never mind, you know. Meanwhile, people in NSA or whatever are doing it, but anyhow.
Sure. But you know, when you have someone who is in that position of like being, I don't know, some version of a craftsman, you know, what they're going to keep up with are the things that they know and the advancement of those things, and not these outside, who, because you get burnt on the new promise of AI is going to solve face painting, you know?
Well, and also like you get the resistance, like when Pixar first went to talk to Disney animators and said, hey guys, we've got this really amazing way we can change your workflow and everything like this. These guys holding their pencils, sitting over their drawing tables, are like, you want us to use computers? Not going to happen. And they pushed away. They pushed it out. They said, no, we're not going to work with this. Mm-hmm. You know, decade before, you had with nonlinear editing, you know, the Avid systems and stuff, and people who cut film, they're like, hey, we got this new way to do this using computers and stuff. And film editors are like, no, I use a Kino. I mean, this is how you edit film. This is how you edit. I can see the frames up close. I can get close. This is a low res thing. I'm sorry. And they resist it because, one, it's like you're telling somebody, hey, you got to retrain and learn this entirely new skill. And you come up with a lot of reasons to say, I don't need to. And next thing you know, you're out of work.
And if you have a certain level of proficiency in say, tape editing versus using an NLE, then all of a sudden, if someone's asking you to use a digital workflow, you don't know. If this is a tool you don't know, you suddenly... Mm-hmm. There's an insecurity of being like, oh, I don't know how to solve these problems. I don't know how to be able to answer these questions. And this is a live fire. This is a client. I have this working machine, or I can jump into this new box and sell myself. You know, that like, I I can sympathize with both viewpoints on that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no. I think this is just part of being a professional, right? Is you know, you get attached to stuff and sometimes it matters and sometimes it doesn't. But if you're in a technical capacity and things are moving as fast as they're moving now, then you are risking not being on the wrong side of that continental drift.
Yeah.
Yep.
Y'all want to do picks?
Yep.
Yeah, let's do picks. I have a pick. I have a pick. Okay, this is a weird one. I talked about this on Chord Killers last week or the week before. It's called is it Chef and My Fridge? Someone sent it into the Chord Killers line, and Chef and My Fridge. It's a Korean cooking show. Netflix has a lot of episodes of it now, and it's where they invite celebrities on, they ship their fridge from their homes into the studio and use the ingredients that are in their fridges for these chefs to make meals and then there's a small competition segment to it. It's really weird. And it's another one of these like sort of flipping the formula on what a competition show is, or what a celebrity involved show is, or what a cooking show is. You know, the first episode of these that I had watched, the first half hour was just them like farting around, talking with the like 8 chefs who at any given time can be cooking something before they even invited the celebrities into the studio. You know, there's a very like almost like late night element to it, just very sociable, which is, you know, very similar to like a panel show, if you know the idea of like a panel show. But what I enjoyed about Chef in My Fridge is it reminds me a lot of Nailed It. Do you guys remember Nailed It, which came out this year or last year?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I never watched it, but that was where bad cooks had to try to do really complicated things, and it was kind of a positive celebration of trying and failing.
Yeah, it was always laughing with you and not at these chefs, because it's very clear, like, they don't know what they're doing. They know they're not. They don't know what they're doing. But it's an even playing field, and it's a very similar thing here in that you have really accomplished chefs doing the cooking here, so they rib each other, and it's a very like jovial atmosphere, and that's refreshing to see, because so much of cooking competition and reality competition shows is very serious and very dramatic, and it really matters who wins and loses. Where here it's like, well, if you win, we'll put a little star on your jacket, and you'll be the guy who has stars on his jacket.
There's something about the idea of lowering the prize to that, which then makes it less, you know, you're less concerned about, you know, the outcome, you know, like, hey, oh, anyway, it's fine. It's not about that, you know, where if you make the prize really big, then it changes sort of the spirit of competition. Who wants to come up, you know, compete? And that, you know, I think that's, right. You know.
And you're right, because it's suddenly not about prize money at all. This show, it's about being funny and doing good cooking, and you know what they get out of it is the ability to say, oh yeah, I took a bunch of random stuff out of a fridge and made something really cool in 15 minutes, and these celebrities said my food was good, and that's the trade-off there. But yeah, it brings the tension much lower. And that's an interesting thing to watch. So that's Chef and My Fridge. A lot they have a bunch of episodes on Netflix right now.
My pick is so I've been working on this 1960 podcast. I'm coming to the end of my research phase. This is Seymour Hersh's The Dark Side of Camelot. So this is obviously a book that is delving into the It was just kind of really weird that a lot of these books that are critical of the Kennedys don't have audiobooks. That's all I'm going to say. A lot of audiobooks for things that are positive about the Kennedys. Very few for the ones that don't. And I think this is probably more to do with, you know, how much people want to put into it. Long story short, this is fairly exhaustively researched, the stuff that I've read the most, because now I'm at a point where I'm just trying to talking a lot about the Kennedys and a lot of different things. And when I'm really kind of focusing on a fairly small portion of it, but this has probably been the most exhaustive investigative work that I have seen about the exact conspiracy that I am talking about, and the connection between the Kennedy family and the Chicago mob by way of a couple of different factors. And it is the first time that I have read anywhere in my research with any kind of firsthand reporting about meetings between Joe Kennedy and Sam Giancana, when it happened, where it happened, like kind of stuff. So Sam Giancana being the head of the Chicago mob, if you're reporting on a mob conspiracy, you're going to wind up talking to a lot of mobsters, and you can obviously take mobsters like to tell a lot of tales. They like to exaggerate things. So there's a lot of, you know, take it with a pinch of salt to a lot of, I think, mob stories in general that, hey, I met with Joe Kennedy and he asked for a favor, can very often turn into, and then we also tried to take down Fidel Castro, and then we also shot Bobby Kennedy, and then we also shot JFK. But it is for going out there and getting somebody to put their name on the fact that this happened and corroborating it a bunch of different times with a bunch of different people, it is very well done. So Seymour Hersh, The Dark Side of Camelot. This is not something, this is not just a one thing that he did. If you're not familiar, Seymour Hersh's work, he's written about the killing of Osama bin Laden and Henry Kissinger and a lot of other stuff. So he is somebody with a pedigree. But if you like that kind of stuff, The Dark Side of Camelot, Seymour Hersh.
Very nice. Cool. I have a tech pick. If anybody out there is interested in coding or whatever, Google has supported a very interesting platform called Flutter. And what Flutter is, it's a development environment that allows you to create apps for both the iPhone and Android. And it uses a language called Dart, which means, yeah, you're going to learn another computer language. But there's a lot of tutorials and stuff out there. And if you're interested in doing app development, but you're like, you know, I've made apps before for iPhone, and I wish I could have made them for Android too, because a lot of friends that use Android, Flutter is a way to do that. Now, it's limited in things that natively work on one platform versus the other. You have to kind of then go into those the versions of the apps that it creates for each platform to go add those features. Mm-hmm. But it's got a lot of cool features and for a lot of basic apps and stuff. And it creates the code natively. So it's not like it's a little magic box that all of a sudden tries to create an iPhone experience or this. It takes the code base and then it outputs native code for iOS or native code for Android, which, you know, can be Java or Kotlin or Swift or Objective-C. So it's a little techie, but there's tutorials. You can find tutorials on, like, you know, they're there. But if you go to udemy.com or, you know, one of the other Udacity or whatever, you can find like Flutter tutorials for like 10 or 12 bucks. They're like 20-hour courses. So if you have an interest in learning, you know, how to code for different platforms, and anytime I start working on a project now, I take a serious look and go, can I make this in Flutter instead so it'd be available on, you know, both.
Yeah, I think I remember you, maybe it was you who had mentioned Flutter a while back, but mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of building out apps through a framework, it's very similar to like the Unity game engine. Mm-hmm. of working from a place of compatibility and cross-platform scope, basically, is really good in a lot of situations.
The challenge, there's been things I've wanted to do and I'm like, man, like it'll be hard because there's some things like they just added like camera functionality and stuff and video to it. It's like there's just like, so that's the, but I can make a version of the app and then say, let me pull up the iOS version, the iOS development environment and go add the camera function and another thing. I haven't, you know, the integration factors, you know, beyond me at this point, but there are things you could do. Like my Story Voice app I made for doing, you know, processing, you know, words to text with, you know, punctuation. I'm looking at it going, man, if I want to revisit that, like, I think I know how to make that in Flutter, so it would be on both platforms. Of course, you know, the headaches of trying to maintain some of the two platforms exist, but just it's just a thing, I think, to take a look at. So
yeah, very cool, Flutter.
Yep. Everybody, it's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.